Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Among our topics, a multi-million-dollar refund if the Jags leave Jacksonville. A new poll shows support actually grows with the cost of stadium renovations. State lawmakers ditch clean energy, even deleting the words climate change from Florida law. The city council gets new leadership, and what yesterday's guilty verdict means for local Trump supporters. To talk about all that and more, I'm joined by Sylvia Perry, editor of the Jacksonville Free Press. Good morning. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Good morning.
A.G. Gankarski, Northeast Florida correspondent for Florida Politics. Hey, A.G.
Hey, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. Anthony Austin, anchor at First Coast News.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, and I know it's an early one for you.
It is.
Thanks.
I'm here.
Thank you, Anthony. And Steve Patterson, reporter with the Florida Times Union. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Ann. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Sylvia, I want to just briefly touch on this verdict. We're hearing support from Republican lawmakers for the Florida president. A lot of voices in elected office coming out to say they don't think that this is a fair trial. Why is it that there is this kind of need by local Republicans to weigh in and say that this was, you know, not a just proceeding?
Well, this present climate is nothing new. Ever since number 45 has been in trouble for one reason or another, his supporters, whether it's the 30% fan base or local politicians that garner his support because they want that 30% to stand behind them, they have been there. So it's nothing new. Unfortunately, it always seems that these are the results of partisan politics and not the facts. You know, one thing you're never supposed to discuss is politics and religion. And when it comes to politics, especially here in the South, it seems like partisan, it reigns supreme. Mm-hmm. And that's where the line is drawn with Donald Trump. If you look at the Democrats, what they say versus the Republican, the Democrats say that the halls of justice have spoken. Democracy has been done. And when you look at the Republican side, they say it's a sham. But yet, on the flip side of the Republican side, you know, we've been doing this for years. We did it with Monica Lewinsky. We did it with Obama and the birth of rights. So people want to say what they say to get their point done, no matter what.
AG, is it an awkward posture for what has traditionally been the law and order party to be decrying the justice system?
You know, it's ironic. I mean, if you remember when Trump ran in 2016, the lock her up chants targeted Hillary Clinton at rally after rally. You know, the implication that he was going to politicize the judiciary to get an end, you know, fast forward full circle 8 years, and we see him hoisted by that petard. So, yes, it is ironic. We've got a lot more civil libertarians and people willing to question juries and justice writ large than we seem to have a few days ago locally with the politicians, John Rutherford, Aaron Bean, Rory Diamond on the city council. But, you know, if you look at this process, I mean, there will be an appeal. The appeal likely will go to the Supreme Court, and that's probably going to be most favorable venue. U.S. Supreme Court is likely most favorable venue for Trump because, you know, it's got a conservative lean. He appointed three of them. It's a 6-3 conservative court. So theoretically that could help. But, you know, this is going to be the backdrop of much of this part of the campaign until you get to the debates. Obviously, Trump's nomination, the convention is 4 days after his sentencing hearing is scheduled now in July. That'll be interesting. A lot of this discussion, this campaign going forward is going to be meta-discourse about Donald Trump and the New York legal system and lawfare, as they call it, and all these things. So this pretty much ensures that the former president's issues are going to be privileged over things that actually affect the American people, because most people will not find themselves in a hush money trial with an adult entertainment star.
Anthony, we've seen, the kind of need to fall in line on issues that have been difficult for, you know, some observers to take, including, you know, the January 6th insurrection, the lie that the election was stolen. But that's kind of become almost prerequisite talking points. I saw there was a tweet from former governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, who's a Republican, but kind of a moderate. And he had said, let's not let this become toxic partisanship. We have to respect the verdict. And one of the Trump officials in his campaign responded, you just ended your campaign. So the threat of not falling in line is real stark.
It is, and I definitely agree with that. You know, I watched all of this unfold yesterday as breaking news, and the former president came out at one point after the verdict and said that the real verdict will be on November 5th on Election Day, saying that that's when people will make the decision. And you have, for example, talking about, you know, falling in line, Duval County GOP Chairman Dean Black. You know, they said that Alvin Bragg campaigned on pursuing a witch hunt against President Trump, and unfortunately he succeeded. And it's a stark reminder of the Democrats' relentless pursuit of political gain, even at the expense of our justice system. So that's coming from our local GOP chairman. But then you have the Democrats on the other side saying that, you know, no one is above the law. And they also said that if people want to make their voices known, make the real verdict is to go to the ballot box on Election Day. So you have, as you mentioned, two sides, but it seems like if you're on the Republican side and you're not falling in line with this, saying that this was unfair, that it was a sham verdict, that the justice system was corrupt, that basically, hands off, you're not a part of us. You're not with us. You're basically against us.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. Even our governor, Ron DeSantis, saying yesterday that basically if it was not President Trump who was on trial, that this would not have happened.
We'll be obviously continuing to follow this over time, but I want to move to some local headlines. Details revealed this week about a proposed deal with the Jaguars, more information that we're getting. Anthony, what did we learn this week in terms of what the Jaguars are agreeing to?
So this is really interesting, and I learned some new details I was curious about myself. So we know if the Stadium of the Future agreement is approved by City Council, many say that this agreement could pave the way for major improvements to the city that go beyond the stadium. So just kind of going over some details with you, we already know that the city would pay up to $775 million of the $1.4 billion cost. Now, the Jags would pay the rest, which is about $625 million, and would be responsible covering any construction cost overruns. But something to clarify that's in that agreement, however, the team will not cover any city cost overruns, including if the overrun directly results from any material delays to the construction schedule caused by the city's failure to meet express deadlines. So that's a direct quote.
I'm real interested in that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that strikes me as like kind of one of those lawyer loopholes that could
right,
really
exactly.
Spell some exceptions to, you know, if the city is creating, Steve, I mean, you've seen contracts over many decades, really, here in Jacksonville. Loopholes have been our Achilles heel.
Well, this is true. And it also is not it's not an area where you think of the city of Jacksonville and promptly meeting contract deadlines, meeting construction deadlines.
You don't.
You don't see that those two as going hand in hand every day. So it's probably a good idea if you're interested in having a quick construction that you put in some arrangement that if you don't have if you don't meet your deadlines, then you eat the cost.
Yeah, I mean that could be considerable AG if the city, you know, is for some reason there's a permitting issue, which there very often is on a scale, you know, on a complicated construction project like this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but you know, I wouldn't overstate these projections too much for both sides. I mean, this is pretty standard in these kind of deals in this era. You know, every side's got protections. You know, from construction costs to the relocation agreement, where basically for 15 years, that would be a full penalty of $75 million for the Jaguars. But if they relocated between years 16 and 30 of the lease, their obligation would be less over time. So, I mean, these are standard things. I mean, this has been the most harmonious stadium negotiation I have ever seen. You hear about these things in other cities where they're fighting about terms, they're fighting about payments, all of that. Mayor Deegan and Mark Lamping have walked hand in hand here, and she has marshaled her considerable political capital for this deal. You know, she has pushed to make sure it hasn't been a referendum. City Council President Ron Salem's been on board. He'll be the finance chair next year. We'll talk about that a little later. But, you know, when you look at these things, it couldn't line up better for this deal to get done. And, you know, they've been exploring the space for a while. I mean, this happened during the Curry administration, too, where, you know, they did site surveys and the like. So, you know, there's plenty of precedent for this. But when I look at these protections, I mean, I wouldn't read too much into them.
Silvio, the community benefits element of this deal, you know, it's separate from the costs that Anthony was outlaying, but it is a central part of what the mayor says and what the Jaguars are hoping becomes this deal. That would benefit the surrounding neighborhoods, also some, you know, parks and areas elsewhere in the city. But that's being treated as a separate entity, and the city council has expressed some, you know, skepticism about passing that additional $300 million proposal.
Well, you have to take the good with the bad. And along with this, the stadium agreement, which has been floating around for years, we're finally seeing it as a reality. And the fact that it will affect the surrounding community definitely brings ire. It's a community that's been around for over 100 years, meaning the East Side community. So they would benefit the most, hopefully. Concerns regarding displacement and gentrification, they're there, and yes, it will happen. It will definitely happen. But the good part is when people will see Jacksonville, they will see good efforts done.
This sort of slides into another topic I want to get to on the UNF polling. But if you're just joining us, we were talking about the week's big headlines. You can join the conversation at 904-549-2937. You can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can reach out on social media. You can also watch our live stream right now on WJCT's YouTube channel or on Facebook. So this poll, Steve, was interesting because it basically said there's a, you know, somewhat moderate, not terrific support for spending on this stadium. But if you add the community benefits element, that support grows. I think people would be surprised, you know, to say more expense is more popular.
Well, but the community benefit money, first, it is city money that's being paired with money from the Jaguars. So it's a way to rationalize, well, yeah, we're putting in something, but it's for this good cause, and another party is putting in money for this, and it sort of gets to a question that skeptics about the Jaguars have asked over the years, which is, yeah, all right, the team's here and they bring flash and color, but what do they do for the city? Well, this is a concrete arrangement, and so people within city council members who want to argue against the community benefit spending will need to argue against the most popular part of the proposal.
Yeah. It's going to be hard to do that, too, because the Jacksonville Chamber and the Jacksonville Civic Council have both said they want the whole deal, including community benefits. Chamber is particularly significant because Daniel Davis, who obviously ran for mayor last year, is the CEO of that. A lot of weight with Republicans. So the people who might be able to find a fiscal conservative lane and chip away at this deal, they won't have any backup if they do that. And history tells us the city council, when people take an overtly populist position without the backup of the Republican establishment, for lack of a better word, it doesn't work out too well. You get some headlines, you might get a couple committee votes in your favor, but I have seen it before where people have made noise about parts of a deal and then, you know, bowed down at the end. I remember a stadium negotiation years back where Danny Becton, who was on the city council at that point, was objecting to the whole thing. Sam Musa, who was the chief administrator at the time, he predicted to me that Becton would cave, and Becton did, in fact, cave. The political pressure is a lot. The ex parte conversations are fast and furious. You know, Paul Hardin, the Jaguars lobbyist, has been working these people along with the aforementioned parties. So it's very hard to resist this. And, you know, the community benefits agreement's a sweetener. I mean, it really is.
It's a win-win for everyone. Mm. And it makes the Jaguars pay a part of it as well.
You know, it's interesting, Anthony, because this poll also looked at what people think about downtown investment. Obviously, the Jaguars are downtown, and so this is kind of a part of it. But They found that even though 70% of residents say they either never go downtown or they only go down a couple times a year, 40% still said that they thought investing in downtown is crucial to Jacksonville's growth.
Right. And I believe that a lot of people do believe that. As someone who lived downtown when I moved here to Jacksonville back in 2016, I kind of wondered, what's happening down here? Everyone told me, this is the year. This is the year it's going to happen. Downtown is going to grow. Mm. And here we are 8 years later, and we're still having this conversation, wanting to see some change in Jacksonville.
And you don't live downtown.
I don't live downtown anymore. You know, something, Ann, that I thought was interesting, most voters polled, nearly 75% supported using $1 billion of public money on a new jail.
Mm. What do you make of that?
I'm not sure, to be honest. But I think it just kind of goes into people want to see the money go back into the community. Yes, we want our entertainment, but.
Yeah, we actually spoke to the Dr. Michael Binder, who runs this poll, who did this poll. And he said that he thinks that those numbers will change on the jail, Steve, as people realize that that's actually going to be coming straight out of their wallet. I mean, kind of unlike the JAGS deal that isn't really raising taxes in an overt way, just extending a tax and shifting some money. He said that there's no more funny money. This is really going to cost.
Right. But there is a traditional support for things that people will see in very vague terms as law and order. And so if you ask people, well, do you support spending money to have law and order in your city and to keep people safe? Generally, they'll say yes. And then when you get into some of the specifics, the questions may very well come up about, so, okay, you want how much from me next year and the 15 years to follow that? And why is this jail that's going to be proposed, why is that going to be necessarily better than the existing jail and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this jail issue is nothing new. I mean, we remember when John Rutherford was sheriff, he was talking about the jail. Mike Williams is talking about the jail. I mean, it never got done. And this comes back to what happens in downtown writ large. It's like every 4 years or every 8 years, you have a change of administrations. The new administration wants to restructure the mayor's office, do all these other things, but actually follow through on what the previous administration did. We saw it with Lenny Curry and Alvin Brown. See it with Donna Deegan and Lenny Curry. And, you know, the bills have come due on these things. I mean, the stadium obviously needs to be done if they want to keep an NFL team. But with the jail, I mean, you've got human rights issues in that jail. They can't hire correctional officers to work in there. It's not a 21st century facility. If you've talked to anybody who's served some time in there, they can tell you the horror stories. Mm-hmm. And the city has a moral obligation to do this jail project. The problem with that, of course, is between the jail, the downtown parks, east side, and the stadium, there's not much capital improvement budget left for anything else. So, you know, things like building up the south side or, you know, north side, places where you're seeing a lot of population growth, there's not going to be capital there to do it anytime soon if these big projects get going. So it's kind of a Faustian bargain for city leaders, but, you know, they've let this ride for so long that the Deegan administration and city council is going to be forced to actually find a way to program some money and find a way to get the money from people. And, you know, that's going to be tough, especially for political futures on people on the right.
But in this case, I mean, every building has a lifetime, and it is getting more and more fair to say that this jail is nearer to the end of its lifetime. Its jails are used hard. And so, you know, if you've had good, diligent maintenance over the years, you can extend the life. That has not been the case here.
And so, talking too about downtown revitalization, you know, we have a jail that sits on prime waterfront property. Mm-hmm. So no one wants to go to a downtown and look at a jail as well. It does not exactly a spirit bringer.
I want to move on to a topic that is always in the headlines, but still the thing that must not be named. That is climate change, at least here in Florida. The governor signed a bill that was passed by lawmakers. It rolls back green energy goals, and it erases climate change from state law. It takes effect July 1. Steve, what does this bill require, and what does it spell out?
This bill basically shifts the priorities in state energy policy. And in the process of doing that, they end up tripping over something that had been a bad look for the previous governor and now looks bad for DeSantis as well. There had been under the Scott administration, Rick Scott's administration as governor, talk about not mentioning climate change, and that was a vague thing to about not bring that up. Here we have a law that was passed in the last legislative session that explicitly removes from the state energy policy the need to address climate change as a consideration, and what that has been packaged as or sold as is an effort to instead focus on things that are tangible and predictable. The governor has talked about focusing on resilience and basically leaving climate change as sort of an outside issue. That's the basic idea.
So I don't know of any like repository of all of the information related to, you know, climate impacted weather events, but just in the past couple of weeks, record high in Key West, 115 degrees, South Florida also getting hit by smoke from Mexican wildfires, 4 tornadoes in Tallahassee that killed 2 people, 5 dead in Iowa after storms obliterated parts of several towns. Downtown Houston still closed in parts because of derecho, destroyed buildings and shattered glass in sky rises. Canada's been on fire for more than a year. Extraordinary rains caused a landslide in Papua New Guinea, killed 700 at least, maybe thousands. Flooding in Dubai killed 10 people. London reporting biblical floods. I mean, this is, you know, not almost literally a daily event. It's a drumbeat that we're hearing. And it's not going to change by taking out the words climate change, Anthony.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I encourage everyone to do your own research about this and make a decision about climate change. There's a lot of people out there who are a lot smarter than us, scientists, who are studying this on a daily basis. And I encourage everyone to go read and see what that research shows. And you were just naming some of the things that have happened here in the state, around the country. I have a statistic here. Florida experienced its warmest year on record since 1895 in 2023, with a statewide annual average of 73.4 degrees Fahrenheit. That's according to state records. And just recently, there was a meteorologist down in, I believe, Miami, down in South Florida, Steve McLaughlin, who I actually, he worked in Texas when I was in college. I used to watch him on TV on NBC back in the day. But he made the decision to take a stand on air. And this is a video that is going viral talking about.
We actually have a little sound. Let's hear what he had to say.
The entire world is looking to Florida to lead in climate change, and our government is saying that climate change is no longer the priority it once was. Please keep in mind, the most powerful climate change solution is the one you already have in the palm of your hands, the right to vote. And we will never tell you who to vote for, but we will tell you this. We implore you to please do your research and know that there are candidates that believe in climate change and that there are solutions and there are candidates that don't.
Anthony, that's a strong decision mm-hmm. for somebody. As you know, you've got to really tread a line about being, you know, equitable on air, but there truly is no denying the fact of climate change.
Exactly. You know, as journalists, we don't take sides. We just report the facts. And as you just heard that meteorologist saying there, do your research. Facts are facts at the end of the day. It's not my belief or your belief. Look at the record. You know, what does it show? Florida over the last couple of years, record heat, record flooding, record raining, record insurance rates, and the corals are all dying around the state. We see it.
Yeah.
Those are just the facts.
Yeah. And Anthony, I mean, AG, as somebody who does a lot of outside time and a lot of walking, you experience this firsthand that the heat really is going to be so consequential, especially here in Florida.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And it's going to be hotter nights, hotter days, more extreme weather events. The things that we've seen in South Florida will eventually come up here. And, you know, going back to the governor's handling of the situation, you know, he positioned himself as an environmental governor in 2018. He spent money in Everglades restoration, things like that. Lake Okeechobee, I mean, these are laudable things. But the mask kind of came off of DeSantis. You know, in 2023, he was on a campaign trip when Fort Lauderdale flooded, had 24 inches of rain in one day. He was in, let's say, Iowa, because that's where he was most of that time. When he do out-of-state interviews, he talked about the insurance market. He said to people, knock on wood to get through the storm season. And there are new insurers in the market. They have done work with that and the reinsurance. The state's put in $3 billion in reinsurance. But, you know, realistically, it's just you've got a governor who has no incentive to take on this issue. You've got a state that's going to have a million more Republicans than Democrats by this election. So the weatherman saying go to the ballot box. That's helpful. But the reality is Republicans are going to dominate the state for a while because people who have moved to the state, the remote workers and the people who are filling up the suburban places and so on, they are here because they like Ron DeSantis. They don't want to hear about climate change. They don't want to hear about any of these things. And, so it's going to be troubling. But the 2026 election for governor, you can bet that Democrats can be bringing up this issue.
Well, we're talking about the top stories of the week with our panel of journalists, and you can join our conversation by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can message us on social, Facebook, Instagram, or you can tag us on X at FCC On Air. I want to shift to local politics a little bit. Jacksonville City Council member Randy White, former firefighter, former department administrator with the fire department. He was elected council president. AG, what do we know about Randy White and his leadership style? And what are you going to be watching for?
Randy White he's a strong, silent type. And this is something that he's been since he's gotten on council. But his words carry a lot of weight. I mean, he got the 19-0 vote, which is ideal if you're running for council president. Not everybody gets that. He was a good vice president. He worked well with Ron Salem, who I said before is going to be the finance chair under the White year atop the council. I think he's going to push for labor negotiations, actually. The cops are looking for a new contract. You can expect fire to want something similar. This is a big deal to him because he came out of the fire department. And, so you're going to have this pressure on the city's budget, on the mayor's office to actually get a deal done that is equitable. But, in terms of the council dynamic, I don't expect much difference because, Randy White and Ron Salem are pretty similar in that, they're consensus builders. They're not, tub thumpers. It's not like you got Rory Diamond or Nick Howland or somebody who's trying to make headlines there. In fact, White's not trying to make headlines. But I'm curious to see how the Deegan administration interfaces with them. It's been kind of rocky at times with Ron Salem. We've seen it in the headlines where there was internal notes complaining about Salem. So you would hope that the mayor and her staff can build a relationship that is harmonious because there are a lot of things that absolutely have to get done this next year.
Sylvia, interested, as this council, it is not representative currently in its leadership in terms of, the demographics of this city. Is that something that is of concern that once have a white male president, vice president in position?
Well, I don't think it's so much as on the color lines. I mean, you think about our past black council leaders, for instance, as president. It doesn't necessarily mean just because you are black that you are, quote unquote, an urban representative. We think of Terrence Freeman, and I'm not speaking personally, but as a Republican, he touts the Republican agenda. So you cannot necessarily say just because somebody meets the color line that they are about that. But I definitely don't think it's a concern. The council makeup has changed over the years. I've lived in Jacksonville all of my life, and we've had far more representation as far as the urban communities over the years than what we have now. I think it's a total of 5 Democrats out of the the total. So when we talk about partisan politics and those that back partisan politics and that what matters, such as climate change, XYZ, it does matter. But we'll, next time we go to the ballot box, that's where it'll count.
We also have fewer women in council than we've really ever had in my time in this city.
But we have a female mayor, so sometimes you have a trade-off.
Steve, one of Randy White's stated goals is, you know, to make sure that the jail moves forward. He said that he wants to make sure that the Jaguars deal is resolved. I mean, we might, there's council meetings that are starting next week on this issue. We might even get it done. They might even get it done under the current president, Ron Salem, who said that he would like that to happen.
I'm sure he would like that to happen, but I got to say, it seems like that's a pretty optimistic thing to hope for. Nothing wrong with hoping for it, but if you don't get it resolved quickly, then you will have some inherent delays while you get into July and you get a new cast of members within each committee, and you lose some time in that. I think basically everyone who's involved with looking at stadium agreements are going to, they're going to already be up to speed. But still, you get into a new year of council membership.
And remind us, I mean, you've followed council and city government for so long, but what role does he play? I mean, there's 19 city council members. How significant is it to be the leader of that body?
The council president assigns people to committees, and how you pick the membership of any committee has a lot to do with what that committee is going to deal with in the coming year. You assign bills to specific committees, so you can impede something if you really want to. But typically, a lot of this is done as just the assigning and such is done just as a good sense sort of a thing. There are certain subjects that should properly go to land use, that should properly go to finance, so forth.
Anthony, he's a former union president with the Firefighters Association, and obviously he has long ties there. As AG alluded to, one of the conversations that's, happening, not so much in the public arena, but kind of, being discussed by leaders, is whether to revisit pensions. Mm-hmm. And that was something that was, we went to a 401, I think they have a 401A as opposed to a 401K, but it's really similar. And they've said it's really hurt recruiting and retention. Less so with firefighters, mm-hmm. Much more so with correctional officers and police, but they are still seeing a diminished hiring pool. I think Randy right. White said one of the problems is that basically everybody that applies is chosen now because they mm-hmm. don't have, much margin.
Right, right. And I know we interviewed Randy White this week, and he did mention that's going to be top of mind for him when it comes to those pensions, to getting some type of deal worked out. Because as you mentioned, he's been a firefighter for more than 30 years, so he knows the importance of that. And I think people are going to continue to look to him to work out some type of deal to get this done. I don't know exactly what that may include or what is the timeline on that? But I think that will be one of his main priorities, to work something out for the city.
And AG, they're looking at maybe involving, as opposed to returning to this pension that was internal to the city and, not bankrupt, but heavily indebted, that required this bailout because of it owes so much more than, it's taking in. Shifting that to the state system and, kind of piggybacking on state pensions.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a costlier option. It would be something to be more palatable to the actual workforce.
Costlier, how?
It would just cost the city more for the pensions than the current plan that was negotiated by the Curry administration. There's a reason that we haven't seen FRS as the mechanism before. Alvin Brown and Lenny Curry both wrestled with pension and both did not go forward with that.
And they explored the Florida retirement system as an option.
I mean, yeah, it was brought up, but it was something they didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason you got to the 401A plan. So, Yeah, if this actually happens, and Mayor Deegan said that she was open to looking at pensions on the campaign trail, you know, FRS would be a thing that would be a boon for this labor force. But just like everything else we've been talking about this hour, taxpayers would be on the hook. And, you know, how much can you actually extract from taxpayers? So that's the question. But, you know, as of right now, I mean, who knows who on council actually resists these things?
What is the magic, AG? I mean, you follow politics so closely. You have things that are discussed for years and years, things like the jail. And then all of a sudden, there's kind of this like impetus, this sudden momentum, and they become, you know, really a project. You know, something like the pension being discussed and then comes to fruition. What is the magic that makes that happen?
You know, the discussion has to happen for a while because you have to get people engaged. You have to get stakeholders engaged. You have to get politicians engaged. And that takes time. I mean, and this isn't just Jacksonville. You look at Tallahassee, it takes a few sessions to get a lot of bills through because you have to build consensus. With something like a big capital project, you know, it's even more uphill. So, you know, having somebody like Ron Salem make the case that he did for the last year on jail and issues like that, that's a big deal. But you have to have continuity. And it goes back to what we were saying earlier. This city does not have continuity because the executive branch, when it changes, you see priorities shift. You know, but you've got a mayor right now who's at 63% in the polls. She has political capital to do some things. And she's willing to take a different look than previous mayors have at, you know, how to actually handle things in the city. So, you know, this is a time for this to happen. The problem is interest rates are at 7%. Borrowing money is not going to be cheap anytime soon. So the timing might not be ideal, but, you know, manufacturing consent takes a while. And when it happens, that's when the iron's hot and you strike.
Sylvia, this mayor had positioned herself as trying to be, you know, a centrist leader and, you know, work across the aisle with, you know, Republicans. How is she doing so far in negotiating that difficult path? Obviously, there's been some difficult partisan battles already, but something like the stadium deal or the pension deal seems to be a more unifying topic.
Yes, and I think that she has done a great job. More so, she's valuing the court of public opinion. And when times get tough, Mayor Deegan goes into the communities, all sides of town, and counts on them to help reinforce her deal. Also, pennybacking on the power of the council president, that again is who sets the agenda. You know, that's who forms the special committees for homelessness, for the jail. You know, so as AG shared, you know, that's how all of this really came to light. The results were revealed on what was going on, how bad it was, in addition to the different news reports. And now it's at the forefront of the agenda, which is what our present council has to deal with.
Steve, you know, the popularity, we discussed the poll earlier, but, you know, Donna Deegan's polling is very favorable. So is Sheriff T.K. Waters. So especially so is our state attorney, Melissa Nelson, not so much counsel, but that's not unusual.
It's not. I think basically I would look at this and I would say, well, people are ready for an election on national level things, but they are not focused right now on grievances about the people in power locally.
And I think Dr. Binder said that the city is generally kind of forgiving when it comes to our local officials, not terribly overly critical in polling.
Right. You know, I was actually looking at the numbers, 47% approval, 42% disapproval for city council. So they're above water overall with most subgroups, except for 18 to 24 year olds and people who haven't graduated college. But I have to tell you, Ann, you know, I do a segment on First Coast News called Ask Anthony, where people contact me about different issues that they're having in the community. And sometimes I'll ask people, did you reach out to your city council member? And they'll say, I don't know who it is. I hear that all the time. So I think a lot of people are just not even familiar with who is on our 19-member city council.
Yeah, and you're their go-to.
Exactly. So I think, as Steve was just mentioning, I think people pay a lot of attention to national politics and maybe the figureheads, the mayor, the sheriff, but when it comes to who's actually representing their specific community.
They have no idea.
They have no idea.
They have no idea. Mm-hmm. We look at the figureheads, and that's who we notice because they're the ones that give the press statements. They're the ones that we see out front. But the city council members, they are few and far in between, other than seeing them handing out an award. If you happen to be at a community meeting or something like that, they're pretty much invisible unless you attend council meetings and you know who they are those Tuesday nights.
AG, I want to just briefly get to our two state senators, kind of getting an update on where they are. We know that Marco Rubio is positioning to possibly be a VP candidate under Donald Trump. Rick Scott is campaigning and raising a lot of money.
Right. And you know, Rick Scott wants to be Senate caucus leader, whether it's the majority or minorities to be determined. He ran for that in 2022. He got 10 votes. This time around, Trump's not endorsing him, but he's running as the Trump wing candidate for that job. So assuming he gets reelected in November, you know, he's going to try to bank on Trump to do better, bank on new people coming to the Senate, all of that. But he's running as a conservative outsider, which is interesting, given that he's been in politics now for 14 years or so. But yeah, Marco Rubio is angling to be vice president. He's been on Fox News about half a dozen times in the last 18 hours. You turn it on, you got Marco Rubio calling in, Marco Rubio in the studio. He's already made the fundraising appeal for Trump. You know, and we'll see how it goes. Obviously, if Rubio is the choice, he'll have to relocate. He'll have to move out of the state.
Because that's a constitutional requirement?
Yeah, exactly. If he wants to get Florida electoral votes, the electors can't vote for two candidates from the same state. Mm-hmm. So this would be in his interest to do that. But, you know, there are a lot of people on Trump's list. I've reached out to Brian Hughes and Susie Wiles from the Trump campaign. They're saying that it's the former president's decision ultimately and that it will happen when it happens. And, you know, nobody predicted Mike Pence back in 2016. So I look at somebody like Doug Burgum. You know, as sort of a candidate who doesn't present the residency issue, who isn't going to overshadow Trump, who seems kind of stolid. I don't expect Rubio to be on the ticket in the end, but he's definitely acting like he wants to be.
And Anthony, I just going to say, it seems like political memories are short. I mean, I do remember, you know, jokes about people's hand sizes and little Marco and the insults that went back and forth. But I guess politics heals all.
I guess you can say that. You know, Ann, I was just thinking, I went to Washington, D.C. during the whole Eureka Gardens situation. I remember you had me ask a question to Marco Rubio, and he was very upset and walked off on me. I can't remember the exact details about that. But yeah, I guess, you know, I was reading, basically, they're saying the best thing for Marco Rubio to do if he wants to become VP is just to kind of stay quiet and let Trump continue to have the spotlight and just kind of stay a quiet supporter.
That's not what he's doing.
Well, Steve Patterson, Sylvia Perry, A.G. Gankarski, Anthony Austin, thank you all so much for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And up next, a celebration of Filipino art, culture, and independence.
Congarean Pin, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpin.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
On the next Florida Roundup, finding Florida teachers. School districts are using tax money hoping to attract new teachers, especially in elementary schools, special education, and science, technology, engineering, and math. If you're a teacher or used to be a teacher, what have your experiences in the classroom been like? Parents and students, tell us about your classroom experiences. Email us radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday at noon.
This week on Science Friday, a lot of companies don't allow you to repair your own devices, but that's changing.
I come bearing good news. There's been actual improvements in the situation.
Why some states are approving legislation that forces companies to give you more repair options. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Guilty. A jury in Manhattan makes history and finds that former President Donald Trump did commit criminal acts to help him win the election. We have the latest. Also, why is President Biden's support among black voters waning? And something else for the record books. Major League Baseball writes what it calls a historic wrong. We get to all of it on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. This year marks the 126th anniversary of Philippine independence, and the local Filipino community is preparing to celebrate. To tell us about it, I'm joined by Tatiana Caballero and CJ Bautista with Jax Filipinos. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Thank you for being back, CJ.
Good to be back.
So Jax Filipinos is a new organization formed last year. What is the group's mission?
Okay. Well, Jax Filipinos' mission is to connect everyone to the Filipino community through community outreach, arts, and culture.
Mm-hmm. And so you are having a festival for Independence Day, but maybe people don't know kind of what a significant part of Jacksonville, the Filipino population, is. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Jacksonville is actually home to over 34,000 Filipinos. It's the largest Filipino just general community in Florida, and one of the largest in the United States. So,
and so this new organization is hoping to aim, like, to raise the visibility a little bit.
Yeah, we're just trying to really highlight the talent, businesses that are just really that shine throughout our Filipino community here, but aren't necessarily highlighted or, like you said, super visible. So, like CJ said, we're just working to really kind of bridge the gap between the two communities and realize that, you know, we're all in the same area. We're all in the same city. So it really works to, it really benefits both communities to, you know, support each other and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
And so this is an Independence Day celebration, CJ, but it is, there's a kind of an interesting history on celebration. I mean, the Independence Day itself, there was actually two. Tell us about that history, why that date was changed.
Okay, so if you don't know, the Philippines was actually a colony of Spain for over 300 years. And over the years, there were many attempts at revolution and trying to get independence. But it wasn't until 1898 that, after some fighting with the Spanish, that they declared independence on June 12th. Now, unfortunately, that independence was short-lived because we now became a colony of the United States. And it wasn't until later on, many decades, that the United States was able to give us our independence, and that was given to us as July 4th, kind of to match the United States Independence Day. And later on, they decided, you know what, we're going to go ahead and celebrate on June 12th as our original Independence Day.
So the date that was assigned was July 4th, 1946, but it was later than in the 60s that the president said, nah, we're going to go back to the date that we declared independence originally from Spain and celebrate that. And so are both dates celebrated now, or is it really just the June 12th date?
June 12th is pretty much the primary celebration date.
Okay. And so let's talk about this, the group that you are a part of, Jax Filipino. You've done a few events so far. Did a event with food at Mosh. It's like a Taste of the Philippines.
Taste of the Philippines. That's been an ongoing event, but we now work with Mosh on that.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And what else? There was a documentary screening that you all hosted?
There was a documentary screening for Nurses Unseen, which was describing the struggle that nurses, and particularly Filipino nurses, had to go through during the pandemic.
Yeah, during COVID. That's right. Yeah, because they are a huge part of our healthcare system.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So talk about this upcoming festival. What can we expect, Tatiana?
Yeah, so Jack's Filipinos, we're collaborating with the Riverside Arts Market on June 8th. We will be there from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And we're going to have a few, we're going to have about, I think, 10 featured vendors specifically for Filipino Independence Day, including Ating Boutique, Her Path Collection. We're going to have Say So Sweet. So we do have a couple of local vendors as well as other Filipino-American vendors, Filipino vendors from the general Northeast Florida area. We're also going to have performers throughout the entire event, including Sun Loli, who is a musician. We're going to have Roots Brigade, which is actually a Filipino reggae band.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of talent in the community that doesn't usually, that isn't usually seen, doesn't usually have a platform to share their talents. So we're just really excited to have the opportunity to, like, highlight them.
And what about food? Because I think of Filipino food as just, I mean, it's so amazing. First of all, is there a place in town that you would recommend for people to have a good Filipino meal?
We were actually talking about this earlier. I work at Abstract Filipino Essence, which just made it onto the Yelp Top 100 restaurants.
Where's that located?
In the U.S. It's on Beach Boulevard, mm-hmm. right by Penman Road, actually. So, like I said, thank you, Chef Jojo, Yelp Top 100. we're very proud of it. But at RAM itself, I believe...
Riverside Arts Market, yeah.
Yeah, at the Riverside Arts Market. Say So Sweet specifically is going to be like one of our local featured vendors.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on. We hope that this is a good event. It's June 8th at Riverside Arts Market from 10 to 3. So good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
And that's our program. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock, but you can also find our entire archive at wjct.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to listen Saturday at 4 when neurologist Dr. Joe Servin discusses brain cancer and how patients with head injuries maintain financial well-being. Join us Monday when we explore the story of a Black former Union soldier and the historic community of Cosmo, where his grave was discovered. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.